The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Mark Weber Report. Mr. Weber is a historian, author, current affairs analyst, and director of the Institute for Historical Review. Visit the IHR at ihr.org. And now, Mark Weber.
Hello and welcome. Earlier this week, Americans marked Memorial Day, an occasion for taking time to remember all those who have suffered and sacrificed in military service, and above all, to recall with gratitude the sacrifice of all those Americans who gave their lives in foreign wars. We recall with sadness the suffering and deaths of so many, the young lives cut short, and the misery and horrors endured by so many more. We remember the young men and women who have been blinded, who lost an arm or a leg, or who lost their sanity, who were never able to lead a normal, healthy life. We think of the many children who grew up without a father because a life was cut short far away from home. Of the shattered hopes and dreams of loving wives who lost their husbands, and of the many mothers who have wept because they lost a dear son whom they had loved and cared for as an infant and as a boy. But I am more than saddened. I am angered because so much of that death and suffering was unnecessary, that so many lives were squandered and wasted. I am enraged by the behavior of cowardly, unprincipled, and ignorant political leaders who, supported by much of the media, have deceived the public to send Americans to death and suffering in foreign wars that could and should have been avoided. One of the most touching and memorable moments of my career was in late 2007 in Eugene, Oregon, where I had been invited to give a talk to a meeting at the University of Oregon. During the question and answer period after my address, a young woman in a wheelchair at the back of the lecture hall told how she had lost her legs in an attack while serving with U.S. forces in Iraq, and then asked about the meaning of her sacrifice. She said, "Why did this happen to me?" Well, I'm not often at a loss for words, but I felt and still feel that on this occasion, my response to her poignant question was far, far from adequate. I responded first by saying that courage and willingness to sacrifice are virtues, and that she can and should be proud of her idealism and devotion to duty. But, I went on to say, her dedication and idealism had been betrayed by political leaders who sent her and many other young Americans to attack, invade, bomb, and occupy a faraway country on the basis of deceit and lies, and for an unworthy cause. Over and over, we Americans are told that the deaths and sufferings of Americans in foreign wars has made it possible for us to live in freedom today. Our political and military leaders tell us that we are free and prosperous thanks to the sacrifices of Americans in past wars. We are told that Americans fight for freedom. We're told that so often that it's become almost a slogan or a cliche. It's another way, though, of saying that all of America's wars have been good, or at least they've been for a good cause. That's another way of saying that none of America's foreign wars have been mistakes. And that suggests, in turn, that America's leaders have never made a mistake in going to war. Dedication, idealism, courage, and willingness to sacrifice are virtues, even in the service of an unworthy cause. And everyone who sacrifices, and dies in war deserves to be remembered with empathy and humility. But all too often in our history, the conflicts and causes in which Americans have been sent to suffer and die have been unworthy and unnecessary. Time and again, American political leaders, supported by much of the media, have sent young people to their deaths and have ruined the lives of many more in foreign wars that were justified and promoted on the basis of deceit and lies, in military campaigns that did not enhance our freedom and which were not for the best interests of our country, or our people, or for humanity. I'm going to talk for a few minutes about two examples of this. The first one is the First World War. It was, after all, the end of the First World War in November 1918 that gave us Armistice Day. That's now been replaced by Memorial Day. And when it ended in 1918, it was by far the most destructive war in history up to that time. Certainly the most destructive war for the United States up to that time, apart from, of course, the American Civil War. The United States didn't get involved in the First World War until April of 1917. The war had already been raging since August of 1914, that is, for several years. The United States, the war began essentially as a conflict between two blocks of nations, Germany, Austria-Hungary, and Turkey, the Ottoman Empire on one hand, and France and Britain and Tsarist Russia on the other hand. Each side believed that when the war began in 1914 that it would be over quickly, that the cost in lives and in money and so forth would not be all that high. Well, as it turned out, the war quickly developed into more or less a stalemate and a terrible, terribly bloody conflict that took the lives of hundreds of thousands and then of millions of young men on both sides. Now, the United States, at the beginning of World War I, was a neutral country. It wasn't actively involved, and suppose it was neutral. But through a combination of propaganda, including a lot of pro-British propaganda over the sinking of the Lusitania and other incidents, the United States moved inexorably more and more toward the side of Britain and France in the war, and in 1917, declared war on Germany. It declared war on Germany for reasons that today seem pretty astonishing. Germany had been sinking Allied ships and in the war zone around Britain, a policy that was later adopted by the United States when it got involved in World War II, but at the time was considered very terrible and barbaric, even though Americans were warned and all the countries were warned that the area around Britain was a war zone and that any ships going there were liable to be sunk because Germany was trying to blockade Britain in much the same way that Britain, of course, was trying to blockade Germany. But the important point here is that the American public was told that this sacrifice for war that cost the lives of hundreds of thousands of young Americans, this sacrifice for war, involvement in the First World War was a necessary one because Germany represented such a terrible tyranny that it had to be, its regime had to be removed, and that the war would mean the end of all wars. This would finally put an end, our president said, to all wars. It was a war to end war. And after this, we were told, President Wilson assured us and the supporters of the war told us, that after the war was over, there would be a period of universal peace when secret diplomacy would be eliminated and conflicts would be resolved forever peacefully. President Wilson also declared and told the American public that the war was necessary because it was a war to, as he put it, save the world for democracy. That the war was a progressive and good war of good versus evil. Well, the contrast between the promises, the pledges, the high-sounding words by President Wilson when the United States got involved in the war on the one hand, and the sordid reality after the war ended, the aftermath of the war, was so great that the American public became disgusted not only by the results of the First World War, but by the call for wars in general. And during the 1920s and early 1930s, the United States overwhelmingly was against involvement in foreign wars. And it took a lot of propaganda to get Americans to change their mind about this. But so great was the feeling of disgust and betrayal by the way that the war actually ended, that American public opinion was completely turned against involvement in future wars. Particularly, after the war, it turned out that Britain and France, far from fighting for freedom or democracy, were using the war to increase their already enormous imperial power and imperial possessions and hegemony over other countries. Germany's former colonies were not made free, but were turned over to Britain and France and other allied countries. Even though Wilson had promised that America was entering the war, which would the peace would be a fair one without any vindictive settlement of the war, in fact, Germany was harshly treated by the victorious Allies. And in Germany, of course, there was an enormous amount of disgust and outrage because the promises made to Germany and the other allies of Germany when they surrendered in 1918 were broken by the victorious Allies once the Germans had laid down their arms. Now, the point here is that in this case, in this very large war, the American public and the American political leaders, and above all, President Wilson, made promises and pledges about the war and the purpose of the war that sent many, many young Americans to their deaths in Europe against on the side of Britain and France. The promises were so untrue, so deceitful, and turned out and betrayed that the American public was disgusted and outraged by the aftermath of this conflict. But this was only one of a number of examples of wars in which Americans have been set off to kill and die and suffer and sacrifice for slogans and for a cause that turned out later to be very untrue. Now, similar deceit and similar lies characterize America's involvement in some of the other wars that the United States has been involved in the years since. But the most recent large-scale war, or fairly large-scale war, the United States has been in recent years was, of course, the invasion of Iraq in March of April 2003 under the presidency of George W. Bush. The U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003 and the occupation of that country since then has cost more than 4,000 American lives and hundreds of billions of dollars, and of course has brought death to many, many more numbers of Iraqis, estimated at tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands. In the months leading up to the attack, President Bush and other high-ranking U.S. officials repeatedly warned that the threat posed to the United States and the world by the regime in Baghdad, Iraq, was so great and so immediate that the United States had to act quickly to bomb, invade, and occupy the country. For example, in September 28, 2002, a few months before the invasion, President Bush said, quote, "The danger to our country is grave and is growing. The Iraqi regime possesses biological and chemical weapons, is rebuilding the facilities to make more, and according to the British government, could launch a biological or chemical attack in as little as 45 minutes after the order is given. The regime is seeking a nuclear bomb, and with fissile material could build one within a year. On March 6, 2003, again, just very shortly before the invasion, President Bush declared, quote, "Saddam Hussein and his weapons are a direct threat to this country, to our people, and to all free people. I believe Saddam Hussein is a threat to the American people. I believe he's a threat to the neighborhood in which he lives. And I've got good evidence to believe that. He has weapons of mass destruction. The American people know that Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction." Well, it turned out that these claims were untrue. Saddam Hussein did not have weapons of mass destruction. He had no nuclear program. The regime of Saddam Hussein turned out to be militarily extraordinarily weak. More to the point, the Iraqi regime, of course, posed no threat at all to the United States. Moreover, the alarmist suggestions that the Baghdad regime was working with the Al-Qaeda terror network likewise proved to be without foundation. So in this case, if the official reason given for the war, reasons given were untrue, why did the United States attack Iraq? Well, whatever the secondary reasons for the war, the crucial factor in President Bush's decision to attack was to help Israel. With support from Israel and America's Jewish Zionist lobby, and prodded by Jewish neoconservatives holding high-level positions in his administration, President Bush, who was already fervently committed to Israel, resolved to invade and subdue one of Israel's chief regional enemies. This was so widely understood in Washington that U.S. Senator Ernest Hollings was moved in May of 2004 to acknowledge that the U.S. invaded Iraq to, as he put it, to secure Israel. And, he went on, everybody knows it. Now, what he meant by that is everybody in Washington, everybody on the inside, knew this, of course. The people who didn't know this were the American people, the people who were supposed to pay for the war with hundreds of billions of dollars and with the lives of young Americans. Senator Hollings went on to identify three of the influential pro-Israel Jews in Washington who played an important role in prodding the U.S. into war. He identified them as Richard Perle, chief of the Pentagon's Defense Policy Board, Paul Wolfowitz, deputy defense secretary, and Charles Krauthammer, columnist and author. Hollings referred to the cowardly reluctance of his congressional colleagues to acknowledge this truth openly, saying that, as he put it, nobody is willing to stand up and say what is going on. He said, due to the pressures that we get politically, members of Congress uncritically support Israel and its policies. A few months before the U.S. invasion of Iraq, retired four-star U.S. Army General and former NATO Supreme Allied Commander Wesley Clark acknowledged in an interview, here's what he said, "Those who favor this attack, that is by the U.S. against Iraq, now will tell you candidly and privately that it is probably true that Saddam Hussein is no threat to the United States. But they are afraid at some point he might decide, if he had a nuclear weapon, to use it against Israel." 6 months before the attack, President Bush met in the White House with 11 members of the U.S. House of Representatives. He told the lawmakers, quote, that while the war against terrorism is going okay, the United States would soon have to deal with a greater danger. And he said, "The biggest threat, however, is Saddam Hussein and his weapons of mass destruction. He can blow up Israel, and that would trigger an international conflict," unquote. President Bush also spoke candidly about why the U.S. was going to war during a White House meeting on February 27, 2003, again, just a few weeks before the invasion. In a talk with Elie Wiesel, the well-known Jewish writer, Bush said, quote, "If we don't disarm Saddam Hussein, He will put a weapon of mass destruction on Israel, and they will do what they think they have to do, and we have to avoid that, unquote. President Bush's fervent support for Israel and its hardline government was well known. He reaffirmed it, for example, in June 2002 in a major speech on the Middle East. In the view of what the London Times called leading Israeli commentators, President Bush's address was so pro-Israel that it might have been written by Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. In an address to pro-Israel activists at the 2004 convention of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, AIPAC, Bush said, quote, "The United States is strongly committed, and I am strongly committed, to the security of Israel as a vibrant Jewish state." He also told the gathering, quote, "By defending the freedom and prosperity and security of Israel, you're also serving the cause of America," unquote. In fact, Condoleezza Rice, who served as President Bush's national security advisor and later as Secretary of State, echoed President Bush's outlook. In a May 2003 interview, she said that the security of Israel is the key to security of the world, unquote. Well, Samuel Francis, an author, editor, and columnist, who was also, by the way, a personal friend, also looked into the neoconservative role in fomenting war. He wrote, "My own answer is that the lie, that is, that a massively armed Iraq posed a grave and imminent threat to the U.S., was fabricated by neoconservatives in the Bush administration whose first loyalty is to Israel and its interests, and who wanted the United States to smash Iraq because it was the biggest potential threat to Israel in the region. They are known to have been pushing for war with Iraq since at least 1996, but they could not make an effective case for it until after the September 11, 2001. In the aftermath of the 9/11 attack, terror attacks in 2001, ardently pro-Zionist neoconservatives in the Bush administration, who for years had sought a Middle East war to bolster Israel's security in the region, exploited the tragedy to press their agenda. In this way, they were backed by the Israeli government, which also pressured the White House to strike Iraq. A leading Israeli daily newspaper, Haaretz, reported in February 2002, quote, "The Israeli military and political leadership yearns for war in Iraq," unquote. The Jerusalem correspondent for The Guardian, the respected British daily, reported in August 2002, "Israel signaled its decision yesterday to put public pressure on President Bush to go ahead with a military attack on Iraq, even though it believes Saddam Hussein may well retaliate by striking Israel," unquote. Moreover, Israeli's spy agencies were a full partner with the U.S. and Britain in producing greatly exaggerated pre-war assessments of Iraq's ability to wage war. This was acknowledged by a senior Israeli military and intelligence official, Shlomo Braun, a brigadier general in Israeli Army Reserves and a senior researcher at a major Israeli think tank. He said that intelligence provided by Israel played a significant role in supporting the U.S. and British case for making war. Israeli intelligence agencies, he said, quote, "badly overestimated the Iraqi threat to Israel and reinforced the American and British belief that the weapons of mass destruction existed." The role of the pro-Israel lobby in pressing for war has been carefully examined by two prominent American scholars, John J. Mearsheimer, professor of political science at the University of Chicago, and Stephen M. Walt, professor of international affairs at Harvard University. They wrote an 81-page paper, The Israel Lobby and U.S. Foreign Policy, which was the basis later for a detailed book with the same title. These two professors wrote, quote, "Pressure from Israel and the pro-Israel lobby was not the only factor behind the decision to attack Iraq in March 2003, but it was critical. Some Americans believe that this was a war for oil, but there is hardly any direct evidence to support this claim. Instead, the war was motivated in good part by a desire to make Israel more secure. Within the United States, the main driving force behind the Iraq War was a small band of neoconservatives, many with close ties to Israel's Likud party. In addition, key members of the lobby's many major organizations lent their voices to the campaign for war, unquote. Well, we'll take a break at this point and return soon with the second half of this broadcast.
Stay tuned for more of the Mark Weber Report. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
NATO has declared it's extending its operation in Libya by another 3 months. The alliance chief says this decision is meant to prove to Muammar Gaddafi that the alliance is determined to fulfill the UN mandate. Let's cross live now to James Corbett. He's the editor of an independent news website. Thanks for joining us this hour. Anders Fogh Rasmussen says it's necessary to carry on the campaign to protect the people of Libya. But just today we heard accusations from Tripoli that 700 have died in NATO airstrikes. How sincere do you think the alliance is in its claims that they're just protecting civilians?
Well, I think the idea of protecting civilians by bombing civilian populations is on its face ridiculous, and in itself exposes that this is not about humanitarian intervention. And that lie has been thoroughly exposed, I think, by the fact that the initial no-fly zone turned pretty much overnight into a bombing campaign, which turned into a campaign which we were promised was not to overthrow the regime and to get Gaddafi out of there, but then was revealed in the New York Times op-ed by Obama and Sarkozy and Cameron that was indeed the exact aim of this. And then there was the promise that there would be no ground troops involved, and now footage has just emerged in the last couple of days showing foreign, presumably British, special forces on the ground advising the Libyan so-called democratic rebels. So I think it's just been lie after lie, and I think that pretty adequately exposes the fact that this is not ultimately about humanitarian intervention.
What do you think has to happen in order for the alliance to consider its mission fulfilled in Libya?
I think that the NATO powers will not stop until Gaddafi has been unseated from power, whether that's by force or whether he actually does acquiesce in the end. I'm not sure that particularly matters. I think the inevitable end here is regime change, and I don't think anything's going to stop until that happens.
Do you think that's why the 90 extra days have been put out there? I mean, it has something got. Why do they need these days?
Well, I think that's clearly the intent of these extra days. I think it might be surprising on one end that Gaddafi has held out this long, especially given the extent of the onslaught against him and the attempts to assassinate him and the killing of his son and grandchildren and all sorts of things that have been tried against him. It's rather surprising that he's managed to hold out this long. And I think that was perhaps not foreseen in the original action that was approved by NATO.
Now, Gaddafi has said that he's ready for negotiations, but the opposition, along with NATO, has said that they don't see a peace deal possible with him in power. Do you think there's no way for him to remain in Libya?
I think that's the ultimate conclusion that we have to draw, and it's one that's...
Let's return to the Mark Weber Report, brought to you by VOR.
Hello and welcome back. When we went on break, I was talking about lies and deceit in the run-up to the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, and particularly the important and decisive role of the neoconservative pro-Israel lobby and group in Washington pressing for the U.S. invasion of that country. Important members of the pro-Israel lobby carried out what professors Mersheimer and Walt called an unrelenting public relations campaign to win support for invading Iraq. A key part of the campaign was the manipulation of intelligence information so as to make Saddam look like an imminent threat. For some Jewish leaders, the Iraq War was part of a long-range effort to install Israel-friendly regimes across the Middle East. Norman Podhoretz, a prominent Jewish writer and an ardent supporter of Israel, had been for years editor of Commentary Magazine and influential Zionist Monthly. In the September 2002 issue, Podhoretz wrote, quote, "The regimes that richly deserve to be overthrown and replaced are not confined to the three singled-out members of the Axis of Evil, what he calls the Axis of Evil, referring to Iraq, Iran, and North Korea. At a minimum," he went on, "the Axis should extend to Syria and Lebanon and Libya, as well as, quote, friends, quote, of America like the Saudi royal family and Egypt's Hosni Mubarak, along with the Palestinian Authority, whether headed by Arafat or one of his henchmen." Well, just to make a brief digression at this point, it's remarkable how differently things have turned out. The Norman Podhoretz and many other neoconservatives have wished for and worked for in the Middle East, because the overwhelming trend in the Middle East and around the world has been increasingly critical of Israel and even in opposition to Israel. Yes, it's true that Egypt's Hosni Mubarak has been replaced, but he's been replaced by a government that is, if anything, more critical, more hostile to Israel than the one that was in place and was a pliant and fairly agreeable one for Israel and supportive of U.S. policy in the Middle East. The biggest change, of course, in the Middle East, in the region, has been the shift toward an anti-Israel policy of Turkey and the important role that Turkey has been playing in the region. And that's the overwhelming trend in that region. Of course, in Lebanon, the government there now includes elements of increasingly hostile, increasingly critical regime in that country as well. And that's the overall trend, not only there, but in many other countries as well, where there's a worldwide consensus, a growing worldwide consensus, that Israel's policies are not only unjust, oppressive, and illegal, but that they're harmful to the interests of the rest of the world. But going back to the run-up to the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, at the time, Patrick Buchanan, the well-known writer and commentator and former White House communications director, was blunt in identifying those forces and actors that were pushing for war at the time. Buchanan wrote, and I quote, "We charge that a cabal of polemicists and public officials seek to ensnare our country in a series of wars that are not in America's interest. We charge them with colluding with Israel to ignite these wars and destroy the Oslo Accords. We charge them with deliberately damaging U.S. relations with every state in the Arab world that defies Israel or supports the Palestinian people's right to a homeland of their own. We charge that they have alienated friends and allies all over the Islamic and Western world through their arrogance, hubris, and bellicosity." Unquote. Well, again, as true as those words were when Buchanan wrote them years ago, several years ago, they're even more true today. The U.S. Special relationship, as it's called by its supporters, the U.S. special relationship with Israel is even more harmful to American interests than it was in the past, and puts America increasingly at odds with the not only the outlook and the attitude and the view of the rest of the world, but increasingly with the interests of the rest of the world. Also at that time, another person who identified the decisive role of the Jewish lobby in pushing for war in the United States was the well-known Israeli writer Yuri Avneri, an award-winning Israeli journalist and author, and a three-time member of Israel's parliament. He wrote at the time that the Iraq War was an expression of immense Jewish influence and power in the United States. In an essay that he wrote some weeks after the U.S. invasion in 2003, he had this to say: "Who are the winners? They are the so-called neocons or neoconservatives, a compact group almost all of whose members are Jewish. They hold the key positions in the Bush administration as well as in the think tanks that play an important role in formulating American policy and the op-ed pages of the influential newspapers. The immense influence of this largely Jewish group stems from its close alliance with the extreme right-wing Christian fundamentalists who nowadays control Bush's Republican Party. Seemingly, all of this is good for Israel. America controls the world, we control America. Never before have Jews exerted such an immense influence on the center of world power." Unquote. In Britain, a veteran member of Britain's House of Commons bluntly declared in May 2003 that Jews had taken control of America's foreign policy and had succeeded in pushing the U.S. into war. Tam Daliel, a Labour Party deputy and the longest-serving House member, said this, quote, "A Jewish cabal have taken over the government in the United States and formed an unholy alliance with fundamentalist Christians." He also said, "There is far too much Jewish influence in the United States." Now, as important and as significant as the role of the neoconservatives was in determining U.S. Middle East policy during the Bush administration, that influence has not diminished under the Obama administration, in spite of statements by President Obama that at least raised the level of hope among millions of people around the world that U.S. policy would be more just and even-handed, and more sensible and prudent in the Middle East. But when it came down to actual U.S. policy, time and again, the Obama administration has backed down from its rhetoric in its actual actions and has capitulated over and over to the Israel lobby, to the Jewish lobby, and to the demands of Israel. Most recently, during the last few weeks, during the visit by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to Washington, the Obama administration in February vetoed a Security Council resolution condemning building of illegal Israeli settlements on the West Bank territory, a resolution that had the support of Britain, France, Germany, 14 other members of the Security Council, and more than 100 members of the General Assembly of the United Nations. Again, there's a world consensus on this issue. There's a realization everywhere that the Israeli building of these settlements is not only dangerous and harmful to the prospect for peace, but that these settlements are illegal and must be stopped and dismantled. And that's officially, and has been for a long time, officially the view of the United States government. But the U.S. government has refused to declare, or at least the Obama administration, has refused to pointedly declare that the settlements are illegal. Well, for many years, American presidents of both parties have been staunchly committed to Israel and its security, including, of course, the Obama administration. This entrenched policy is an expression of the Jewish Zionist grip on America's political and cultural life. It was fervent support for Israel, shared by President Bush, high-ranking administration officials, and nearly the entire U.S. Congress, that proved crucial in the decision to invade and subdue one of Israel's most important regional enemies. While the unprovoked U.S. invasion of Iraq may have helped Israel, just as those who wanted and planned for the war had hoped, it has been a calamity for America and the world, and of course for Iraq. It has cost many tens of thousands of lives and hundreds of billions of dollars. Around the world, it has generated new distrust and hostility toward the United States. In Arab and Muslim countries, it has fueled intense hatred of the U.S. and has brought many new recruits to the ranks of anti-American terrorist organizations. Americans have already paid a high price for their nation's commitment to Israel. And we Americans will pay an ever higher price, not just in dollars or international prestige, but in the lives of young men squandered for the interests of a foreign state until the Jewish Zionist hold on U.S. politics is finally broken. Well, of course, this is the situation with regard to the Iraq war, but the record of American leaders going to war, bringing the American people into war on the basis of lies and deceit is not confined, as I mentioned earlier, to the Iraq war. This was true with the regard to the First World War. It was true also with regard to, for example, the Spanish-American War, where an intense public relations campaign blamed the blowing up of an American ship in Havana Harbor on Spain, even though there was really no evidence for that. And the United States invaded Cuba, declared war against Spain, and took over the Philippines and Puerto Rico, making the Philippines and Puerto Rico possessions of the United States and Cuba a protectorate or a subordinate state of the United States, all on the basis of false claims. First, that Spain had carried out an act of aggression or war against the United States, and second, on the basis that the United States was supposedly fighting for freedom. In fact, almost as many Americans died in putting down a rebellion in the Philippines for independence of that country, a rebellion to keep the country from being independent and secure American hegemony in the Philippines, as Americans died in the war against Spain to acquire the Philippines, Cuba, and Puerto Rico. Perhaps the most another blatant example of deceit was in the case of the Vietnam War, where the Johnson administration in 1964 lied to the public about the so-called Gulf of Tonkin incident to push through the so-called Gulf of Tonkin resolution in the U.S. Congress, giving the president blank check, open-ended authorization for military action in Vietnam. And the lies and deceit of the Johnson administration were manifest not just merely in the Gulf of Tonkin resolution and incident, but throughout the war years in which the Johnson administration over and over made claims that the later the public learned to be untrue about the course and the nature of the conflict. A larger issue in all of this is a clear understanding in U.S. foreign policy, a clear focus in what even the goal and interests of the United States are. A country that proclaims that its goal in going to war is freedom or fighting tyranny puts itself in a very dangerous situation, because it's an open-ended invitation to endless war. A country that claims that it's fighting to rid the world of tyranny is going to be almost inevitably involved in wars till inevitably, because there's no end of tyranny or injustice somewhere in the world. And it also puts the United States in this dangerous situation, dangerous position as a so-called policeman in the world. And but this is, I think, a reflection of the lack of identity of the United States in the normal way, in the normal sense that most countries have of their own interests. Because a country's sense of its interests is closely tied up with its sense of identity. A nation that has a settled and a clear idea of what it is, who it is also able to better define what its interests are in the world. And the United States, because it lacks that kind of clear cultural, racial, ethnic, or religious identity, is therefore less able to be precise or clear in its sense of defining its interests in the world. For that reason, the United States is to a great degree an ideologically driven country, claiming to speak for on behalf of abstractions like freedom around the world, but this is in practice a very dangerous, elusive, plastic definition that is used by American leaders and has been used by American leaders over and over again as a prescription for conflict and war. To put it more concretely, American leaders define the security interests of the United States far more open-endedly, far more ambitiously than that of any other country in the world. And as a result of that, the United States has a military power and a military force in the world that dwarfs that of any other country by far. Numerous military analysts and experts say that America's military expenditure and force in the world is equal virtually to that of the rest of the world combined. Certainly, in any case, U.S. military power with its vast naval armada around the world, its ring of military bases in many different parts of the world, is far, far greater than that not only of any other country, but of any other group of countries around the world. America has military bases in a number of countries in Asia, in Europe, in Central Asia, and of course in the Middle East. And our leaders tell us over and over that these are essential for America's security needs. But the obvious deceit or untruthfulness of that is shown by the fact that no other country around the world believes that its security needs require this kind of huge military presence in the world. Brazil or France or Italy or Russia or China none of these countries have military bases around the world to secure their real or imagined security needs in the way the United States does. But the United States has military forces stationed in Korea, Japan, Germany, many other countries, against and unable to define even who these military bases are aimed against. Who's the potential enemy in this case? When the during the 1950s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, this enormous American military power in the world was justified above all by pointing to the threat from the Soviet Union and to the Warsaw Pact alliance of countries in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, which was a formidable military force. But when the Warsaw Pact alliance fell apart and the Soviet Union collapsed and Soviet troops withdrew not only from Eastern Europe, that is Poland, Hungary, Czechoslovakia and so forth, but even from portions of the former Soviet Union, the Ukraine, the Baltic states, and so forth. After the collapse of the Soviet Union, of course, the justification for this immense military, U.S. military presence around the world should have disappeared. And many Americans rightly hoped or anticipated that with the collapse and end of the Soviet Union and the danger or threat from the Soviet Union, that the United States would be able to greatly reduce its military presence around the world. But what happened, amazingly, was not that. Just the opposite happened. Instead, a new enemy was conjured up by the American media and American leaders to justify not only the maintenance of this huge military presence around the world and this immense military force around the world by the United States, but to even increase this U.S. military force in the world. It's fantastic. In other words, new enemies, This time it's called Islamic terrorism, or the threat of worldwide terrorism, was conjured up as a substitute for the Soviet Union and the Soviet threat in the world as a new reason to justify this huge military presence around the world. The emptiness of this claim, I think, is shown by the experience of the Vietnam War. The United States sent tens of thousands of young Americans to their deaths in the Vietnam War, a huge and costly, terrible conflict that dragged on for years and caused immense divisions in the American public and so forth, before it finally ended with the unification of Vietnam under the Communist Party of Vietnam. But the dangers that were conjured up and given to the American public to justify the U.S. presence in Vietnam turned out to be completely untrue. After the U.S. Left Vietnam, and after Vietnam was unified and the U.S. left the country, not long after that, Vietnam, in fact, went to war against China. That the claims, and thus showing the emptiness of the claims made over and over by American leaders during the Vietnam War, that unless the United States fought that war, China and Vietnam would together take over all of Southeast Asia. Nothing like that happened. In fact, in a way, just the opposite happened. The influence, the importance of nationalism was far greater than the ideological importance of communism for China and Vietnam. And today, the United States the U.S. and Vietnam are major trading partners, and there's a large amount of imported goods from Vietnam into the United States. That the United States has been able to live peacefully with Vietnam since the end of the war, I think underscores and shows the emptiness of the claims during the Vietnam War that the United States had to fight that conflict to prevent the so-called communist takeover of the country. But the important thing in all of this is that American leaders, either through ignorance or deliberately, are unable to express a clear and consistent expression of what real American interests are. And that's closely related to their inability to define in a consistent way even what America is as a country. The more America drifts as a country, unable to define its identity as a country, as a nation, the more it's unable to define clearly its foreign policy objectives and interests. Well, that concludes this broadcast of the Mark Weber Report. I urge you to check out the IHR website at ihr.org. There's an enormous amount of material on the IHR website, and I also invite you to write to me with any comments, suggestions, or questions you may have about this broadcast or other aspects of the work of the IHR. Our email address is ihr@ihr.org, or directly to me at weber@ihr.org. Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll be on hand for future broadcasts of the Mark Weber Report.
Thanks for listening. The Mark Weber Show returns Wednesday, 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. Time, only on VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.